Hey, before we get started with this week's episode, I just want to give you a quick announcement. This is Deidre, and I am here to tell you that we have something brand new and exciting. And in case you haven't heard, I'm going to let Megan share with you how you can join our Patreon community and why you should.
Yeah, we just started our Dauntless Grace community, and it's through Patreon. And by joining us, you are working with us to support our mission. You can access exclusive content like behind the scenes videos that, are just mine and Deidre's faces with some special guests, plus bonus content from a lot of our really, really special guests. You can join a vibrant community and enjoy special perks like retreat discount pricing. So head on over to dauntlessgrace.org/community to find out more.
And there's more than just that. So if you didn't hear, you should go check out that link that she is telling you about because we also have monthly coffee and chat calls where we talk Enneagram. And for the next level up, quarterly co group calls with therapists. So I'm telling you, this is a really cool community to be part of, and you don't want to miss this opportunity.
Dauntlessgrace.org/community.
Welcome to the Dauntless Grace Exchange. I'm Megan.
And I'm Deidre. And today we have a special guest with us, Joe Saxton, who we are just absolutely delighted to have on the podcast. Funnily enough, we were just telling her that we are currently at the Wesleyan Holiness Women's Clergy Conference right now. And it was 2 years ago at the same conference that we were introduced to Joe as the main stage speaker. Yeah. So excited to have your voice in this space. I'm going to introduce you officially by your bio. Joe is a speaker, podcast, and author. She's the founder of the Azer Collective, an initiative dedicated to investing in women leaders around the world, equipping them to own their voice and boldly step into their calling. She currently serves as the executive director of the 25, a leadership development initiative at Bethel University. Born to Nigerian parents and raised in London, England, Jo now lives in Minneapolis with her husband and two daughters. She loves everyday stuff like good music, good food, and good friends, and we are honored to have you here. So welcome, Jo.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
We actually, it was your message about calling us to arise to our voice that we heard from you 2 years ago, and we were so impacted by that.
Yeah, this girl actually had a total life-changing moment when you spoke that word. I don't know if you remember it, but you were talking about Deborah rising up.
Yeah.
You should just tell the story.
Well, I was going through a season where I was, had been raised as a Christian. My parents were pastors of a church. I just assumed I would do pastoral work my whole life, and life transitioned me into other spaces, and I didn't understand why. My name is Deidre, but it's spelled D-E-E. And when I first was like middle school learning, everybody was looking up what their names mean. It was like Deidre was this sorrowful Gaelic dark death, all of these things. I'm like, Mom, why did you name me that?
Thank you.
She said, that's not who you were named after. One of their best friends was Deborah, and everybody called her Dee. And so they wanted to name me Dee, but they thought that was too short. So she's like, you're really a Deborah. And what I found in my life was I was busy. I did a lot to kind of cover some insecurities and things that I had. And I didn't own my voice in that space in the same way. And you were reading the scripture that Deborah said to herself in the song, I, Deborah, arose. And there was just a shift for me. Like, I just owned my voice and identity in that moment. That was really cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so powerful. Wow. Thank you for letting me. Wow. That's amazing.
You had a lot more beautiful things to say, but that was the moment where I was like, I think you're talking to me. Yeah. So, and in the last 2 years, I've really moved into a new calling, and I just really appreciate it. I think that you had an anointing that I needed in that. So.
Wow. So that's amazing. Thank you.
Yeah. But tell us a little bit more about you besides what's on your bio.
Oh gosh. I've lived in the States for about 20 years now. Initially we moved to Phoenix and then in California, lived in the twin cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul in Minnesota for the past 12 or so. And I guess in terms of work and journey, I think there's always been a passion for leadership. I think even before I understood what leadership was, and so have, like many of us, have worn many hats over the years. So I was a youth pastor I was a college pastor and got into planting, and we planted congregations as a college pastor when I was in the UK, and began speaking more publicly since living in the States, have worked, was with an organization that came alongside churches doing discipleship and mission. And and I think it's just varied from place to place. I think, I mean, if you get the gift of years, then you hopefully get to try different things. And I think I've always come back to asking how a leader's doing in whatever sphere I've been in, because I think the through line for me has always been the health of whatever we're doing, in business, in nonprofit spaces, in church spaces, tend to have a very intricate relationship with how that leader is doing.
What are some of the things that you see as consistent stories that lead to like burnout or walking in unhealth in those leadership spaces?
I think the Hall of Fame would be the need to please people and to keep people happy would be like when you've got something to prove. Would be one. I think some of the things are gendered as well. What I've seen with women leaders over the years is almost in a bid to justify their presence there, the amount that they'll give physically, emotionally, and mentally to a space may not be best for them, to put it mildly. I think other things I've seen is when we put our gifting and our skill set above our character and our well-being. You can get away with that for a good long while, but the wall that you run into could have some really devastating consequences for a long while. I've seen that a lot of that, and I mean we're only human. Mm-hmm. I think the honest thing is we're only human, and I think sometimes leaders expect of themselves and people around them expect them to be superheroes, and superhero expectations in a human body never ends well. It just never ends well. And so I think those things have been the cause of burnout and spectacular. And when I say spectacular, I don't mean in a positive way. I mean more like just the reverberation, spectacular collisions in teams, in organizations, collision, confrontation with reality, choices that people make. And they are choices that are made which have destructive impact on their lives and their relationships and their families for decades. Do you know what I mean? I think when a leader falls in one way or another, the ripples, I mean, ripples sound gentle. I think it's more like the tsunami is uh-huh. vast.
Yeah. Yeah. I heard in some of those examples you were giving, I heard what I would identify as different Enneagram types in there. We talk a lot of the Enneagram on this podcast, and you know, the twos are the natural people pleasers, and maybe the threes have something to prove in this space, or, you know, the eights are driven by, you know, less their character sometimes and more about like their skill sets. And I'm just hearing the broken kind of patterns that exist within all of us that can just, you know, fluctuate depending on what type we are or what we've endured. But what is it that you've gone through? You said, before this podcast started, you told us that you were an Enneagram 8. And I'm just curious, from your perspective, what are the things that you've done to make sure that that isn't the thing that's driving you, that it's more that you pulled your character into the forefront, that you are being driven by who God created you to be and not the things that naturally are going to like push you into those spaces?
Yeah. And I think that's a question that I've had to keep on a loop throughout the year, over my life. And I think I had a head start, and this will sound odd, but when I hit my college years, I did so at a time when it was very clear that I was very desperate. In terms of, I think sometimes the college years can open the lid on your life and you're like, oh, that was weird. Or do you know what I mean? Because you're hanging with other friends from, and you're like, yeah, okay, so that was dysfunctional, what I grew up in, or all those kinds of things. Mine was a bit more obvious than that. But what was clear to me when I was about 18, 19, 20 in those years, I thought, I don't know how to function. And it was very, I mean, I was a believer. I'd come back to the Lord at that point, and I was just very aware of the broken pieces of my story and the knife edge that I was on in terms of character, in terms of if I don't, like, I either fix this or I drink my way into oblivion. I either fix this or guys will be my answer. There wasn't very much a like, oh, maybe you'll drift. There was no drifting for me. I was
all in.
I'm all in. I've just got to choose what I'm going to be all in with. Yeah. And it was very apparent to me. I mean, it's like I loved the Lord, but I loved a lot of things. And it was apparent to me that I needed to somehow find a way to find my way to surrender the broken pieces of my story and invite him into them. And I knew it wouldn't be a quick fix because nothing arrived quickly. So nothing was going to leave quickly. But I didn't trust myself otherwise. I didn't trust the decisions I would make, the choices I would make, my capacity for vices. I'd grown up in an environment where in my neighborhood, where friends of mine were, by the time we were adults, were in the depths of addiction. And so I'm like, I don't care how strong we think we are. When you've seen it that up close, not in my own life, but in the lives of others, you're just like, you know, these were people I thought were stronger than I was. And so clearly strength in my 18-year-old definition of it was not enough. Right. And so I think what that did for me in my younger years was probably humble me and make me more vulnerable than I would have been comfortable to be. Mm. And in terms of vulnerable enough to say to people, I don't know how to do this, yeah. or I don't know how I'm going to make this, or I need help. It probably caused me to ask for help because I was just so acutely aware of the other versions of help that my peers and my community had. I'm like, okay, well, we'll just suck it up and anyway, just suck it up and get the help you need. But I think also what it taught me is one, God's capacity to heal the broken pieces of our story, but the role of community in that, the role of people in that. And so even though I dislike feeling vulnerable and dislike showing weakness, I think what I accidentally stumbled on was a pathway that would be that one taught me, yes, that what was going on the inside was way more important than what was happening on the outside. Cause I was a straight A student, talented and all kind of, all of those things were fine, but I was very aware that one, I wasn't the most talented in my neighborhood. And I saw all these talented people's lives get completely crushed for decades to come. And so I knew that was not going to cut it. Do you know what I mean? I'd stumbled on the reality that what's happening on your inside and your character is way more important than your gifting, and that you need to attend to it. And I'm grateful. I mean, I'm grateful that that was a lesson that I couldn't avoid very early on, because I think I'm pretty sure I would have. Honestly, I think I would have thought I could play a good game for way longer than I could have done. But I think there was so much healing and so much freedom, and there's so much breakthrough in a way in those early years that any attempts to resist that, and there have been many on my part to resist that, were confronted with the reality of what God did in those, like in that kind of my 4 or 5 year period of my life. And I think, and so what I've learned what I've also learned is that comfort can lie to you. Comfort and convenience and probably a little bit of wealth and all of these things, when I wasn't as desperate economically or socially and all of those things, you can suddenly think that you got it together by your own means. And so I've, in the different chapters of my life, there has been a disruptor of some kind, like moving, not even bad disruptors, moving country, getting married, having young children, disruptions all day kind of thing. Remind you that you can't control everything, and expose you. Even if they're not in the roles that you're in, even aside from the jobs, just in life, that they're very revealing. And I think I have learned to not resist where disruption can take me, in the sense of, you know what, that you feel vulnerable, you know where to go with this. You know what you're likely to do with this. You know that what your vices could be like in this moment. You know what it's like to try and power through, and you know where you should go. So I think those have been the things that kind of that sowed some very big seeds, and I'm eternally grateful for, so that I couldn't believe my own press, or at least that it was harder to. I mean, sadly, denial's a great, powerful thing. So you can deny your own press when you want to. But I think in those early years, it taught me a lot about character being more important than gifting, and that effectively you lead from the inside out.
That's so good. Yeah, you're throwing a lot of words in there that we talk a lot about here, but like getting to a new story, that redeemed story that you talk about that the Lord has for you, requires some vulnerability. And I think for
every person in one way or another, every Enneagram type, like vulnerability is hard. Yeah. But for you to say like there was a surrender.
Yeah.
How do you, as you begin to engage with others who you can see are on that path of I've got it all together, I'm going through the motions of like my own making and the world of my own creation, but you know that like, how do you lead others to desiring to surrender or to wanting to, I think you even use the word kind of like it exposes vulnerability yeah. when we get in these situations where we could double down on how we've always done it, or we take that as a moment of for a breakthrough, you know, that requires vulnerability. How do you create those spaces for people?
I think I've had to remind myself that story is really powerful. I think, and much as I would love to inspire people there, because it's like, you can do it, do you know what I mean? Woo, let's go, kind of thing. That would be my preference, to be honest with you. But I've had to reckon with the reality, you know, I'm very different to where I was 25, 30 years ago when I was in my teens and things, and in my early 20s. And so now it's sometimes if you don't take people, invite people into the store, I'll say what I do for me. For me, it's been important to invite people where appropriate into parts of my story and to model it from where, from my vantage point now. You know, when I was in my 20s, people were like, yeah, we know you were crazy. Do you know what I mean? Do you know what I mean? We were there, or you know what I mean? My friends or anything like, oh gosh, yeah, you don't need to teach us. We were with you. We recall. But now, in a different country, in a different environment, at a different life stage, they can just sound like slogans. And so I think for me, you can't force anybody there. You can't, as much as I would love to, particularly when you see the destructive past someone's on, you're like, oh gosh. And particularly if you know you're going to be involved in picking up the pieces, I'm just like, you know what? I ain't got time for this. So can we get to it? That would be my ideal. But I've had what in terms of creating spaces, I want them to, when I'm working with leaders, I can't lead someone to a place I'm not prepared to go. And so my 30 years ago is one story, but what does it mean now? And so what does it look like to wrestle with vulnerability now? And where is it appropriate for me to say, this is what it looks like for me today? And these are the parts of the story that are the fault lines of the story that still tap into who I was when I was a kid and still feel vulnerable, and what it plays out now as a 50-year-old woman, this is what it looks like today. And I found that has been helpful, because I don't know that I would try. I mean, in classic Enneagram 8 terms, I guess I don't trust people naturally.
Right.
I'm like, I don't believe you. I'm like, I don't believe you. And so in some ways I don't feel that people should trust me unless I'm being honest, unless I'm being real in some tangible way. That feels like far healthier, far more important to model it, and to have spaces where it's not accusatory, it's not judging, and it's not intense for no reason. So maybe this is a slight Brit thing, but I want to be self-deprecating in these things as well. To put someone's defense weapons down, I think they've got to feel like, they've been there too. But it also helps if people are laughing in a weird way. I think that there's just a levity about it, that if you can create spaces where people can be honest, but they can also have fun in some ways, or at least kind of be like, oh, we're all weird, kind of, and it not feel like honesty is something you've got to achieve and perform, but that you're inviting them onto a journey. I found in my experience that leaders have been able to say things that they've maybe not been able to say in other places, and admit things even to themselves that perhaps they wouldn't have felt ready to, because the stakes were too high in other spaces.
You said, you know, as an eight, you think being honest is important. I would say every eight is like, I'm always honest. I always tell like it is. And generally in that unhealthy space, that could be telling other people how it is about other
people. Totally.
So I think what you're saying is like to admit it to themselves, that's the real vulnerability that you probably had to get to. And all of us have to get to it. We all have defense mechanisms up around those really tender parts of ourselves. But to be able to admit those weaknesses and that vulnerability to ourselves and then to speak them out honestly, that is the journey, right? That is, Brené Brown would say, the place where connection happens in those vulnerable spaces.
And my observation, I don't know if you'd find the same, is that it costs different people differently, doesn't it? It costs what it costs, maybe an Enneagram 3 who's more into the achievement to say this didn't work, you know, is different. And whereas someone else will say, well, it was an experiment, it didn't work. Do you know what I mean? And that's not the point of vulnerability for them. And so I've had to learn and to respect when leading others that vulnerability does not come in a package. It doesn't come in a one size doesn't fit all. And so there are sometimes when I'm talking to people and people think I'm being really vulnerable, and I actually say, no, that actually doesn't cost me anything to tell you. It doesn't. And then there are times when people have missed when I'm being vulnerable because they thought, oh, well, that's not a big deal, but it is to me. And it's hard for me. And so part of the creating the space and for leaders is for them to be to not perform vulnerability.
That's good. Oh my gosh. I'm an Enneagram 4. So for me to go tell you everything that's wrong with me might look really vulnerable to people. And I thought it was me living transparently, but that's my own defense mechanism to tell you everything that's wrong about me before, just to see if you're going to stick around for a connection.
Yeah.
There's no real vulnerability in that because I'll just throw it all out there. So I think you're right that it really is different for everyone, like what's driving them, what they're protecting.
Yeah. I wish I had learned that earlier as a young leader in the church. I just assumed that if people showed up, it needed to look like the same intensity I was showing up with the same vulnerability I was showing up with, the same willingness that I was showing up with. Really? And now, you know, we'll host retreats and there are some people that are in the room and like major flight risk. We don't know if they're going to come the next morning, if they're going to Uber home that night. Like they're so terrified, such social anxiety, or just terrified of showing up and not knowing how to engage with the content or whatever. And for them to just even be in the room is so vulnerable, where I'm like, open up your heart and tell me all about your traumatic past, you know. But maturity has shown me like they're showing up in the way that they can at this time, and that's really vulnerable. And if I can reward that without exploiting it, you know, like if they can be safe in that with that risk, then there'll be more opportunity later for more vulnerability and trust to be built. So like talk, just kind of walk us through what that looks like for you, like at your Azar Collective, like how do you begin to build that in those intensive weekends with people?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a number of things that we've learned and stumbled on over the years. One of the things, because it's a gathering of leaders, there's certain things in the space, like there isn't a green room. There isn't a, because there's only 80 of us there. I don't need that. I just need to know where my purse is. Do you know what I mean? I don't need, and that's more to do with me being a Londoner, nothing to do with anything, the event. I like to know where my purse is. I like to know where my stuff is, where are my car keys. I lose them on a regular basis. Somebody show me where they are. That's the winning. And then I think there are other parts of it. Like when we begin, we often say to people, we don't know what it took for you to come here. We don't know what you had to rearrange. I mean, you guys know what it's like for a woman to get to a conference. I mean, my goodness, the project management it took to leave that home. And I say whether that woman is married with kids, whether that woman is single, the project management it took that woman to get there. And the people that they were checking in on, taking care of, the emails. Oh my gosh, the emails, all the things. It sometimes I some of it is just acknowledging, because being seen is important and being seen is so valuable. So I like to start it by just saying that we've seen you. And then because I think it's Barna who had this study saying, what is it, 20% of Christian professional women, and that's across industries, aren't in church on a Sunday. I just want to acknowledge those things at the front and say, you know, for some of you, you may be feeling great with God, and some of you are like God question mark. And some of you is like church is great. Some of you like have been so burnt, bruised, et cetera, et cetera. You do this thing, but you're not doing anything else. And I just say, wherever you're at, you're welcome here. And I like to assume difference. So I say, you know, we're different. We think differently. We vote differently. We are different. That's okay. We're grown. So I think some of it is the table that you set is really important. One of the other things at the beginning, just to kind of set the space, is because it's a smaller gathering, a bit like your retreats, we introduce ourselves, but we get every woman to introduce herself and just say about, because again, they're all leaders and we're wanting them to know that, and it's a leadership intensive investing in their leadership. And sadly, we don't need to do much research to know that those women will not have had an easy journey in their journey of leadership.
Sure.
So there are some things that are good to say. My friend Steph says this a lot. It's like, what's good to say out loud? And it's good to say out loud that you're a leader, and to hear other women in the room say they're leading too, just does something. I'm not even entirely sure I know what it does. And again, stumbled on that one by accident, but no.
I feel like I was on the Barbie movie when someone was getting the prize and it was a female. And she's like, I worked really hard for this. Like, women aren't allowed to say that, right? We have to be so unassuming and apologetic that we're leaders or that we got some recognition. But it's like, in this perfect world, like, yeah, I worked hard for this and I'm humbled by this recognition, but I receive it. It was
absolutely. And I think saying I am the CEO of a company, I am senior pastor, I did this is really important. So those are some of the things. And then again, it's a combination of recognizing in the room there are people who need to talk it out and others who need to reflect. And so just designing the time to that recognizes the difference in our personalities. Having some spaces, there's always, and again, I mean, as I'm talking this through, I'm like, yeah, so many things, my life has been just a stumbling onto things that have worked. And where we have a cross, there's always a moment in the course of the time when we just have nowhere else to take this junk. Do you know what I mean? That's the only way we can put it, and say what do you need to what in you wrestling with who you are on the inside and who you're becoming on the outside is a death to self, is a death to the, it has been a death in the journey, and who would understand it better than anybody else. And that has often been a moment, and we have smaller spaces and different size groupings and that, but so there are lots of little things that are seeking to say you are seen, you are heard, and what you do matters.
I feel like that's a lesson to our listeners who aren't leaders and who aren't creating spaces for other people to gather and are just wanting to walk in more vulnerability. What does it look like to sit across the table from someone and say you're seen, you're heard, you matter, and like this is a safe space for you to process the things that maybe you need to surrender. And I'm not going to use that as a weapon against you. I'm not going to use our differences
as
combative, you know, like that's just, that feels like a humaning lesson that you're giving us.
I hope so. And I tell you what, one thing I will say, we've had to be really careful with even the idea of it being, of calling a space safe, because it's meant different things for different people. And so we've kind of leaned into the language of, is it a brave space? Because it doesn't feel safe for some people. Like they're, I mean, and again, you never know. You just never know who's in the room and what's brought. Like we've had to, like when we've had gatherings, because of people's professions and things, make sure that they were not involved in any of the filming. We've had to say to the camera people, like when you do the pictures, not her. Just avoid her. Do you know what I mean? Because for it to be known, there was one person who had a very, very unique job, and I'm like, okay, and I said, do people need to know? I knew what she did. I said, do people need to know what you do? And she said it'd be helpful if they didn't actually. I mean, it's not illegal. It's just very specific. And so we're like, what's the general term we can use? do you know what I mean? And or others at conferences I've been at, and this was like 10, 15 years ago, where a woman was basically on the run from an abusive spouse, and she needed to not be seen. And so we've had to kind of even tease what is safe to you, what isn't safe to you, what is important in you showing up, and is there anything in our language that can help this effectively be a safe space by even acknowledging that it doesn't feel safe.
Yeah, I like that language, brave. That's really good. That was like a Brené Brown word too.
I'm sure. I mean, it again, I did not originate that in any way whatsoever. I heard it somewhere and thought, oh, that's nice.
I love it. It's good. I mean, I haven't heard her specifically say that. I feel like, do you follow Brené?
Yes, I do.
So much of what you're saying, it's like, oh, I just It feels like a sisterhood here. Like, yes, we're all speaking the same language. It's so beautiful.
As we're kind of wrapping up this section, I wanted to talk a little to one of your books, specifically The Dream of You. You're really addressing like how our, what it looks like to lean into that identity that we've built on lies and guilt. And, you know, we talk a lot about shame on this podcast, not as something we want, but like how it informs so much. We were
talking about
shame. Two thumbs up. How can we lean more into that? Oh gosh. But yeah, like what it requires though, kind of examining that, you know, and bringing it out into the light so that it does dissipate the shame around it. Just wondering in your own life, like what that story has been like, or as you journey with people in more intimate places there, to identify those broken narratives, to identify, you know, what it looks like to bring that into the light.
I mean, on a practical level for me, therapy has been great. Do you know what I mean? Simply put, and having the kinds of friends, having like there are pockets of friendships where it's like I still have very close friendships with friends in the UK, which is helpful because they know me differently. They've walked certain things, and there are things that it's not that I'm hiding them from anybody else who I know now. It's just that when they've known you since you were 18, they know. Mm-hmm. They know stuff. Do you know what I mean? They were there. They encountered you at parts of your journey, or when they knew you in your 20s, when you were just starting out in ministry, they remember, because we all lived it together. And I think staying in places where I'm known, mm-hmm. has been really important, because I think sometimes in leadership, if you're public facing, then it's very easy for people to, I mean, and this isn't, I'm not even saying I do it or anybody else does it, but there's a transactional moment where you're speaking at an event, or you're writing a book, or you're doing a podcast and everything, and you say as much as you can, but that's, it can't help but not be as multidimensional as possible. Right. By virtue of the occasion by which you meet. So I need to be sure that there are places in my life which are unpacking things as life goes on. I think I have a prayer partner. We pray 3 mornings a week. That has been, that's been the lot. And that came out of a crisis, a church crisis that we were in about 10 years ago. And it was not, and it was, it, there's never been a reason to stop. And I think that has been helpful to, because it's regular. Do you know what I mean? I think there's, you need, for me, I find places where I'm known, things that are regular. I think so many of my battles have been won, not by strength, but by the sheer rhythm of it all. Mm-hmm. The fact again and again and again, you're just tapping on this same thing. And it, you know, life is busy enough. If you're only connecting with someone on a level once in a month, or do you know, if all your spaces are like once in a month, I mean, some things are, but if all of them are, then you're having to start again every time. In the mix of things where you're being vulnerable and open and tending to your soul, it needs to be regular. Mm-hmm. Something needs to be regular enough to, because it catches things, it catches habits, and I just need places to process life. Mm-hmm. I need, because there are old stories that reappear, you know, that so I'll give you an example. I turned 50 last week, and my friends, thank you. Yay. But I didn't feel excited about it. And it wasn't about aging. It was, I know exactly what it was. My friend wanted to throw a party and everything. And what it was is, when I turned 40, we had this terrible church situation, which was very, and it happened just after my birthday. And so we had a big party, all these things. And then within a week, most of the people at the party were no longer talking to me. And it was just, it was this dev, and it was just the start of a very, very terrible year. And so as my 50th came, I'm like, I don't want a party. I don't want another thing, which is going to be a thing. And I didn't realize I felt like that, because there had been work done and healing and prayer and all these things, but there hadn't been another landmark like that. Mm-hmm. And so what was helpful is, as that came up, that there were people who were there at that time who I'd say, you know, this is why I'm feeling weird about this. And they're like, we get it. We get why you're feeling weird about it and why this feels tender to you. However, you do get to celebrate. And this is why you're not where you were 10 years ago. And this is why you're not at risk. And no, we can't pretend that everything's going to be perfect in every chapter of our lives. But these were the vulnerabilities then. This is the growth that's happened. This is where you are now. Can we have a party now, please? Let's go. And unless you've got proximity to those people and resources on a regular basis, how do you know? Because otherwise I could have said, yeah, I'm worried about aging. That's not what the worry was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not what the wound was. Yeah. That's not where the fear really was. But you have to be known for that. So I think for me on my ongoing life is, life presents things which will leave you gasping and bring you to your knees. This last year have seen a number of situations and known a number of people involved in situations of clergy sexual abuse and things that have come to light, and just leading people through that stuff and guiding people through hearing. Yeah. I mean, it messes you up. It really messes you up. And so some of the things are really obvious things that'll everything bring your vulnerability to the surface and say, how are you going to tend to your soul? Are you going to just do the being strong for everybody and being angry for everybody and wanting justice for everybody? Or are you also going to deal with how this, just the weight of hearing and feeling and wiping tears and all of that? So sometimes life will bring it up, but then the rest of the time, there are just the rhythms of paying attention to your heart and your soul and your mind so that when the big things come, the framework is there.
Good. One of the taglines that we use in our ministry a lot is that healing happens in the context of community. And I think that you just so beautifully laid out why that's important. It's the being known, it's the being seen, it's the being able to have someone mirror back to you what is actually going on inside. So I just appreciate you sharing that.
Yeah. So good. Gosh. So tell our listeners how they can find you, engage with what you're doing and find your books.
Yeah, you can go to my website, joesaxton.com, that's a good landing part there, and it'll show you the books that I've written in recent years. It'll tell you about AZA and the next gathering, which is in November. We're going to do leadership and power, because apparently we like looking at hard things. And you'll find all these other stuff there. And so on the socials, I had enough of, well, it's called X now, isn't it? I still call it Twitter. I ended that relationship. But Instagram and everything like that, at Joe Saxton. So yeah, come to the website. You'll find it all there, or find me on social media at Joe Saxton. It'll be great to connect.
Awesome. Thank you so much for giving your time to this. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
And that wraps up another episode of the Dauntless Grace Exchange. Be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast app and leave a review so other people can find us.
You can follow us on social media to stay connected. We're on Instagram at Dauntless Grace Ministries, and our Facebook page is Dauntless Grace.
For more about the Enneagram, visit our website at dauntlessgrace.org for coaching and training opportunities. And you can follow me at Enneagram Megan on Instagram.
And be sure to check out our website for more information about today's podcast. Plus, you can click the resources tab to find books by all the authors we've spoken to or about. And you can find it at dauntlessgrace.org.